KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we'll split the hour up as we focus our attention on China and talk in the first part of the hour about the protests in Tibet, and then look ahead to the March 22nd election slated to take place in Taiwan. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. The biggest anti-government protests against China in nearly two decades began on March 10th in Tibet and quickly intensified and turned violent. Led by Buddhist monks, the pro-independence protests marked the 49th anniversary of the failed Tibetan uprising against Chinese control of Tibet that led to the sending of the Dalai Lama into exile. With an imposed Chinese Monday midnight deadline for protesters to surrender and troops sealing off Lhasa, Tibet's capital, things seem for the present to have quieted down. But in this forum segment, we want to turn our attention to Tibet. We'll be talking in the second segment about the elections coming up in Taiwan. Let me tell you who is joining us for this segment. We want to welcome Xiaocheng, who is director of the Berkeley China Internet Project and professor of journalism at UC Berkeley, and joins us this morning from the East Bay. We welcome you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us from Washington is Jeffrey Bader, who is director of the John L. Thornton China Center and senior fellow in foreign policy with the Brookings Institution. And we welcome you, Jeffrey Bader.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. We're also joined this morning in this first segment by Sitin Fanucharas, who is a board member and past president of Los Angeles Friends of Tibet. And she joins us from Malibu. And we welcome you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me begin, Xiaocheng, with you, because I want listeners to understand that it's difficult to get information out of Tibet. The death toll has been estimated at around 80 as a result of these protests, but we don't really know, and we know that troops have sealed off Lhasa. Talk, if you would, just initially about how information is getting out of there. It's a little bit like Burma, isn't it?
Well, it's quite like Burma, as a matter of fact. At the beginning, there were tourists and the local residents who took some photos in cell phones or right on their blocks. But very soon after the Sintern violence, the government immediately closed down and filtered out every bit of information they can reach about Tibet. So it became extremely difficult to find any discussion, photos, or information about those events now, although there are still a limited number of information being leaked.
So foreign journalists are, in effect, barred. We know somebody's there from The Economist, but for the most part, they're simply not on site.
Right. Foreign journalists, journalists from Hong Kong, from Taiwan, they were not on site, or they're being barred to go on site, or some of them been there but being expelled. And we have to remember that last year, China made a particular opening this gesture that say the foreign journalist can interview anyone in China before and during the Olympics. But as soon as this thing happened in Tibet, all that are gone.
And Jeffrey Bader, what about this midnight deadline? What do we know in terms of the severity of it being enforced, and also the fact that we've got supposedly, for the face of things where the Olympics are concerned, the police and paramilitary largely, but also reports that the People's Liberation Army is involved, like Tiananmen Square.
The People's Armed Police will take care of this situation. I mean, the Chinese are acutely aware of possible impact on the Olympics. The reaction by the Chinese authorities so far may not look moderate to outside eyes, but the Chinese authorities, I think, believe that by their standards, they exercise restraint. So there have been some reports of live fire, and as you indicated, we've had reports of up to 80 dead, but I think the Chinese are trying to get the situation under control with minimal bloodshed. They will certainly there will certainly be arrests and detentions. The fact that foreign journalists are not there will facilitate Chinese restoring order, and that obviously is going to be their first priority. And the fact that the Chinese have allowed lots of anti-Tibetan and in some cases racist comments on blog sites to proliferate in the last few days indicates that that they're not going to be constrained, and they don't intend to use restraint in terms of making making arrests.
They've also been reporting, that is, Beijing and the Chinese government has been reporting that there have been ethnic incidents against the Han Chinese, against those Chinese who are not Tibetans, by Tibetans. What do we know on that score?
Well, what we know is that this is a long-standing grievance of Tibetans, that Han Chinese, and not simply Han Chinese, but lots of Chinese, Muslim Chinese, have been moving into Tibet in recent years. China's strategy in Tibet has been to try to increase the Han population and to develop Tibet's economy, and they think that those two factors taken together will decrease traditional support for independence or for substantial or genuine autonomy and integrate Tibet more and more into China. It's a strategy that has had, I think, some success, but in the long run, I don't think it's destined to succeed, and I think that these latest outbursts indicate that they need to rethink whether that strategy is really going to deal with the fundamental resentment of the indigenous population of Tibet.
Jeffrey Bader again directs the John L. Thornton China Center and a senior fellow in foreign policy with Brookings Institution. And Sitan Phanucharas is a board member and past president of Los Angeles Friends of Tibet. The Dalai Lama is calling this cultural genocide.
That is true. He has stated that. And you can tell by what has been happening in Tibet over the last many years. You know, this is just finally, I guess, the people couldn't take it anymore because especially in the last couple of years that they have really gotten into interfering in religious matters, going so far as to say that the communist government is going to determine the reincarnation of religious leaders, religious teachers. They are in every monastery, a communist party member overseeing and quote-unquote re-educating, meaning they make people, monks, when they join the monastery, they have to sign piece of paper denouncing the Dalai Lama, for example. So it was just getting to a point where Tibetans feel completely marginalized in Tibet. And that is the reason, because, you know, language, education of in Tibetan is discouraged and so forth. So those factors all have led for Tibetans to believe that they are genuinely being marginalized, and there is definitely cultural genocide going on.
And the strategy of increasing the Han population would be part of that, I believe.
Yes, very much so, increasing the Han population, and especially with the advent of the train that started about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, that, you know, has just exacerbated the problem.
But there have been a lot of Han Chinese leaving Tibet because of the protests and because of, the violence.
You know, the last I heard that they had stopped the train, but I had not heard whether they had restarted the train going from Tibet. And I'm not hearing news reports of, you know, any large numbers of Han Chinese leaving Tibet leaving Lhasa, for example.
I don't know large numbers, but there certainly have been numbers who have been leaving from what I've read. There's also been some concern or consternation about what has been perhaps seen as not good Buddhist practice in these violent protests. Could you comment on that?
It is not good Buddhist practice, but I think given the provocation that they, you know, seeing peaceful demonstration by monks who were just, you know, doing it very peacefully for the first 3 days, and then when they saw the arrest and beating of the monks, I think the lay people lost their, you know, temper, and then in the moment, heat of the moment, they all of the, you know, pent up frustration of 50 plus years just came to a boil, and I think that's the feeling we all get.
We're talking about the situation, ongoing situation in Tibet with protesters and ethnic Chinese in conflict, and deadly violence having taken place. I'm going to open up the phone lines. I want to extend thanks to first to Sitin Fanucharas, who joined us from Los Angeles. She's a board member and past president of the Los Angeles Friends of Tibet. We're going to continue with Xiao Cheng, director of the Berkeley China Internet Project and professor of journalism at UC Berkeley, and Jeffrey Bader, who directs the John L. Thornton China Center and a senior fellow for foreign policy with Brookings. If you have something that you'd like to say about Tibet, or if you have a question that you'd like to bring into the discussion here, we certainly welcome your phone calls. And let me indeed tell you how you can join us, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Phones are open and available to you. We're going to move in the second segment onto another related topic, the elections coming up in Taiwan. So if you have something about Tibet, now is the time to call. And again, the toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite to join us, is 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, join us by email, and the email address here is forum@kqed.org. And I'm going to go to your calls and emails forthwith. But first, let me just ask you, Xiao Cheng, how do you think this is going to play out with respect to the Taiwan elections? Certainly, the pro-independence party can say, as they are saying, this could happen in Taiwan, just as it's happening in Tibet.
Well, we already seen such editorials and articles and voices in Taiwan now. It certainly does not help the other side, which is more lean towards unification or more interaction with China. Since the Dalai Lama has been always advocating for this one country, two system, which, you know, giving Tibet full autonomy, but with staying within China. And, of course, the Chinese government never have accepted that proposal. But from a Taiwan pro-independent force perspective, this is their opportunity to sort of telling the Taiwan Republic that, look, they couldn't even get a one country, two system in Tibet. Look what's happening in under Tibet, under the Chinese communist rule. Then imagine if we become this one country, two system regime, which is exactly what Chinese government proposing to Taiwan. So that's where this argument become turned in favor of the pro-independence because what's happening in Tibet.
And before I go to your calls and emails, Jeffrey Bader, you had mentioned the 2008 Olympics, and obviously China's trying to keep things to a minimum as far as bloodshed here, just so that the games won't be disrupted. But there, when you add this to the upheaval in Burma and Chinese alliance with North Korea and Chinese what some see as complicity in Darfur, it doesn't necessarily, in terms of the whole human rights record, add up to a possibility that there's going to be all this welcoming of the Olympics in China.
Well, no one should be surprised that there are human rights problems in China. And anyone who expected that the awarding of the Olympics to Beijing was going to result in dramatic changes in China's handling of human rights or attitudes towards democracy or its foreign policy, I would contend is living in a dream world. We all naturally hoped that it would have some marginal impact, but the Chinese leaders have a long-term approach to issues of political and economic development, and I think they see the Olympics as an issue of image management. So again, we should not be surprised. Now, many groups, such as the Save Darfur groups, Tibetans, environmentalists, advocates of democracy in Myanmar, are rightfully shining the spotlight on China's conduct in the run-up to the Olympics. I think that's entirely appropriate. I think they should do it. I would not advocate a boycott of the Olympics, nor would I expect dramatic changes in China's conduct in these issues running up, but there's no reason why we should not be highlighting these issues and putting pressure on them.
I was just reflecting this morning, the last time there was a boycott by the United States Olympics, it was because of Afghanistan and the Russians in Afghanistan, a rather strong irony and all that. But let me go to our callers and find out what their thoughts are on Tibet. Patricia, you're first. Good morning.
Oh, thank you. Good morning. I just wanted to say that when you really go back to the 1950s and the time when the Chinese came in and They destroyed 6,000 monasteries, just razed them to the ground, and killed over a million Tibetans. And I think that the Tibetans, you know, at this point in time, you know, when we have the kind of global awareness we do, we should be working to have the Tibetans have their freedom and have their spiritual freedom. And having been to Lhasa 2 years ago, I know that the Chinese, you know, the intention of the Chinese is really to, if they're going to maintain a few monasteries, which they do, it's for tourist purposes. And the Tibetans themselves do not have the kind of freedom and spiritual freedom that they deserve. And so it's completely understandable that the anger is rising right now.
All right. We thank
that's
you.
That's my comment.
I appreciate that comment, and we'll let that opinion stand, and we'll go on to more of your phone calls. Let me go to Saratoga. Neil, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to ask, the Dalai Lama has called for an international investigation into the recent events, and with China sitting as a permanent member of the Security Council, I'm wondering what meaningful options does the international community have to really do anything about this?
Yeah, it's a good question. He has indeed called for an investigation. Jeffrey Bader?
Well, the caller is absolutely right that with China on the Security Council, we won't see the model that was used, that's being used, for example, for the international investigation in Lebanon into Syrian activity there. The Chinese clearly would never allow that to be passed. I think there are other possible mechanisms. The UN Human Rights Council has what they call special rapporteurs who look into human rights abuses such as arbitrary detention. I think that we could press for the Chinese to accept a visit by the by one of their rapporteurs to investigate the situation. The International Committee of the Red Cross sometimes looks into these situations, but we do have to understand that the Chinese are going to treat this as an internal matter, and they're going to resist any kind of international inquiry.
Let me thank the caller and move on to some more of our calls. Udi, join us. Good morning. You're on forum.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is with respect to the cultural genocide, as it is referred to, rightly so. The Tibetans are really facing two fronts of cultural assimilation. One is really forced in Tibet. The other one is the Tibetan community in India. My wife and I had the occasion, the privilege to volunteer in 95 in India. We worked with the Tibetan government in exile. We did some empirical research, and what they're facing there is a sort of a benign assimilation into Indian society. India is definitely the host and has done great favor to the Tibetans, but they're facing a cultural assimilation there. And then there's the more malignant assimilation that is occurring in Tibet. If I may, just a quick anecdote here. I was in Tibet in 1995, and we went to a city called Shigatse. And early in the morning, you have loudspeakers just spewing out Chinese revolutionary songs, just brainwashing the Tibetan people. At one point, we were walking into a monastery, and there was this young monk walking, surrounded by security guards. And then I speak Chinese, so I went ahead and asked them, "What is this?" And they said, "Oh, this is a living Buddha." So basically, it's a puppet stated by the Chinese government that will basically adhere to their own rules. So anyway, I am really disheartened by what's happening in Tibet. Tibet is a separate country. Tibet has a separate language, separate religion, separate history. Tibet ought to be free. The Tibetans ought to receive their freedom. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Udi, for your call. And let me go back to Xiao Cheng, who directs the Berkeley China Internet Project and is professor of journalism at UC Berkeley. And Professor Cheng, we're getting reports of not only protests going on throughout the world because of what's going on in Tibet, but more specifically and more importantly in Beijing and in China.
That's right. Well, first of all, it's across the Tibetan's region in several different provinces within China. And some of them, like Aba, Sichuan province, apparently turned into violent. And we already have seen photos and information of the deaths and, of course, crackdown. Then the protests spread to Beijing because there is one particular university have the Chinese call minority national the nationality students, who many of them were Tibetans, ethnic. Just yesterday, there was about 40 students staged a silent protest on campus. So that's what's going on in Beijing.
Now, would you say that this is a link to the democracy movement of Tiananmen Square in 1989, or just simply compassion for the Tibetans?
I think right at this stage, it's a compassion with Tibetans. And many of those students were Tibetans or minority students themselves.
Let me bring more of our callers in. Dan, thanks for waiting. You're on. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just have two comments. The first is there any proof about the government, Chinese government, is beating up the monks in Tibet? Like, from what I learned from the internet, I only saw, like, a small group of monks and mobs. They burned shops, burned cars, beat up civilians. I didn't see any, like, police is beating up monks. And also, I have a comment about another caller earlier, like if the countries are divided by culture and language, I'm not sure how many countries will end up in this world. And that's all from me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jeffrey Bader, can you comment on the remarks of the caller?
The fact that the Chinese have not allowed foreign journalists in and not allowing oversight, outside oversight of what's going on, is cause for concern. Exactly how they are treating people, I don't think we have good evidence. We certainly know from the past reports on human rights issued by the State Department that beatings and torture are far from unknown in China, and particularly in Tibet. I think that in the coming weeks we'll probably have Tibetan refugees coming out from Tibet into Nepal and into India, and I suspect that we will get reports from them about what has actually gone on. I'm certainly not terribly sanguine about what's going on there.
Hugh, let's get you on here. Good morning.
Good morning. Of course, what is happening there is what also lays in store for labor activists in China, those protesting for workers' rights, which affects also the price of goods and competition in the U.S. But I'd like a little backdrop on the historical interaction of Tibet and China. Many Chinese Americans say that it's, Tibet is a province of China, and that therefore China should be able to do whatever it wants.
Hugh, we've got seconds left here, and rather than going into the whole conflict as we have before on Forum, suffice it to say that China claimed control of Tibet as its territory in 1959 and has claimed ever since that it's part of unified China. In our second segment, in fact, we're going to talk about the election in Taiwan, and of course China sees Taiwan as part of unified China as well. We're coming up on the end of this first segment, however, and let me extend thanks to those who participated. We spoke briefly with Siten Fanucharas, who is a board member and past president of the Los Angeles Friends of Tibet, and I want to thank her, as well as Jeffrey Bader, the director of the John L. Thornton China Center and senior fellow in foreign policy with the Brookings Institution. He joined us from Washington, and we also thank Professor Xiao Cheng, director of the Berkeley China Internet Project and professor of journalism at UC Berkeley. When we return, we'll do some analysis about the Taiwanese elections and talk about how this is affecting those elections coming up March 22nd. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're going to move now to another China-related topic, certainly related to China's vision of itself as Greater China. On March 22nd, Taiwan voters will elect a new president, and whoever is chosen between the two who are running from the DDP, or Democratic Progressive Party, and the KMT, the Kuomintang Party, will work to build closer relations and lessen the tensions that presently exist between Taiwan and the Beijing government of mainland China. Outgoing DPP President Chen, a strong advocate of Taiwan nationalism and separation from Beijing, has also put on the March 22nd ballot, a non-binding referendum in which Taiwan's citizens decide whether they want to apply to the United Nations under the name Taiwan or the island's former name, the Republic of China. Taiwan left the United Nations in 1971 when the General Assembly recognized the communists as China's legitimate government. In this forum segment, we want to focus on the upcoming elections, and let me tell you who is joining us here in studio, and that's Eric Chenhua Yu, who is Research Fellow and Program Manager for the Democracy in Taiwan Program at the Center on Democracy, Development and the Rule of Law at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. And we welcome you, Eric Yu.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. Well, as I said in my introduction, particularly in contrast to what's going on in Tibet, there seems to be, at least from both of these candidates, the desire for closer ties with mainland China.
Yeah, that's true, that even though that Frank Shea is from DPP, but at least from, well, in last December, he when he made an argument about his cross-strait relations strategies, he argued that he also wants to liberalize Taiwan's investment in China. He also wants to have a frequent charter flights between Taiwan and China. Also, he welcomed the tourism from China to visit Taiwan. So he's kind of a moderate in the DPP, even though he's from DPP.
Well, but on the other hand, we have the present president. President Chen has put this referendum on the ballot, which speaks to Taiwanese nationalism and separation from China.
Yeah, that's true, that because President,
talk in the mic, if you will.
Okay. Yeah. President Chen is trying to push the agenda of the Taiwan independence, and even though that Frank Shea admit that it's not his initiative, and last December he spoke to the AIT American Institute in Taiwan's director Stephen Yang, saying that if the referendum got passed, it simply indicates that Taiwanese want to join the international community, and it doesn't mean that Taiwan will declare any de jure independence or try to change the official status of.
And it's a non-binding referendum.
It's non-binding.
It really just has to do with joining the UN again, really.
Yeah, and now I think the KMT simply boycott the DPP's proposal, that application for the UN membership in the name of Taiwan. So I don't think the referendum will pass the 50% participation mark.
But how much to have a lessening of tensions and better relations with China is the key to this election? I mean, that's the centerpiece of this election, is it not?
Yeah, and cross-strait relations is the centerpiece of this election. And you can see the different approach regarding this issue. First of all, I think Ma Ying-jeou, the KMT's president, tried to...
The one they call Mr. Ma.
Yeah, Mr. Ma. Yeah, Mr. Ma tried to focus on the economic dimension. So he wants to have... He wants to adopt the EU model to seek economic integration with mainland China. But, not the political dimension. And... Frank Shea emphasized on security issues. So
forgive me, Frank Shea is the Democratic Progressive Party candidate, right?
Yeah, Democratic DPP's candidate, Frank Shea, focused on the security issues. So he tried to paint Mr. Ma as a person who advocated for the future reunification between China and Taiwan. So I think even though Frank Shea is a moderate, but he still prioritizes security as the first top issue, and he doesn't want to. I think now he's playing the card of China threat, saying that once we get economic integration, then inevitably we will have some kind of a political integration.
Chris, you've also got a new parliamentary system in Taiwan, too.
Yeah, this year, this is a special year that Taiwan also has a parliamentary election. And now the KMT enjoy a supermajority, which...
You got 113 seats. That's out of how many?
The KMT has 81 seats, but together with KMT's allies, the total is 86 seats. So it's almost three-fourths of the total seats. So that's
a little confused on the numbers because there used to be 225 seats, right?
Yeah, but so this year is a new system, and we changed our system as a two ballot system. One part of this, the 73 seats were determined by the single member district, and the rest will be determined by the party list, and the KMT and its allies got 86 out of 113 seats. So it's really a supermajority.
This is the old party of Chiang Kai-shek. This is the Kuomintang.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But they're certainly, at this point, from all the polls, indicated as the likely winners. That is the presidency under, as he's called, Mr. Ma.
Right.
How is Tibet influencing this election, as you see things?
And especially, I think, that Tibet situation kind of emerged in this campaign, especially this week. And now I think I think DPP's candidate Frank Hsieh tried to use Tibet's the current situation as a China threat, arguing that once Taiwan got a close relationship with China, that could be the case in happening in Taiwan. That is that's just simply a China threat card. And Mr. Ma took a different approach, arguing that Taiwan is totally different case comparing with Tibet, and because the Communist Party never ruled Taiwan, so we shouldn't compare ourselves with Tibet.
But how much does Taiwan want to maintain its independence? It wants to economically integrate, have closer ties, flying over the straits, back and forth, all of that, but maintain its independence? Both parties want to maintain their independence?
Yeah, that's we can call it as a we call it Taiwan's subjectivity. So they want to, well, it's from Ma Ying-jeou's perspective, although Mr. Ma wants to have economic integration, but he wants to maintain Taiwan as a separate political entity. That's a key point. So he keeps focusing on the so-called cross-strait relation, try to use that as a phrase to frame the situation between mainland China and Taiwan. So the cross-strait relations includes two political entities. One is mainland China, the other one is Taiwan. That try to use that as a framework to work in the economic.
We're talking with Eric Yu, who, by the way, is an expert on cross-strait relations, and you can join us in this discussion. We're coming off of a discussion about Tibet, but now looking toward the elections of March 22nd in Taiwan, when Taiwan will vote for a new president and also a referendum, which is non-binding but nevertheless has a good deal of significance. Former president putting it forward as a way, again, of showing Taiwan's independence from mainland China. If you have questions about the Taiwan elections or would simply like to join our discussion, we cordially invite you to call us now, our toll-free number, and it's open to you whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your calls. Any questions or comments you might have for our guest, Eric Yu, the number to call, 866-733-6786. And I'd ask the listeners, particularly those who follow Chinese politics, how you feel about these upcoming elections, particularly in light of the fact that China has, how shall I put this? I'll put it gently. Taiwan has always been a thorn with respect to not only China and of great concern to China wanting to, frankly, take back Taiwan, but also where the United States is concerned, because there's been a lot of tension in the recent administration over the fact that there have been tensions between Taiwan and Beijing. And it's safe to say that both of these candidates will represent a diminishing of those tensions. And so some of you may want to comment on what that all bodes as well, particularly since we've been talking about all the human rights violations in China and the concerns about those violations. Again, our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786, or join us by email. The email address here is forum@kqed.org. And I think it's safe to say what I've put forward here, Eric, that is, regardless of who's elected, the United States probably will be pretty happy compared to what they presently have.
Right. I agree with that assessment, that the U.S. is simply indifferent between the two candidates. But we learned that the U.S. indeed opposed the referendum proposed by President Chen. And given the current situation, that the referendum will be invalidated because it won't pass the 50% participation mark. So I think the U.S. now simply wait and see to see who's going to be the next president, and believe that that probably will open up the dialogue between China and Taiwan.
What kind of turnout do you expect for the presidential election?
Well, from 2004's experience, Taiwan has had 80% of turnout, but I think this year will be won't reach the 80% mark, probably 75 or 76.
And what happens to President Chen and those who feel the way he does, that Taiwan needs to be much more separate from Beijing and, in fact, create that kind of tension that existed under his administration?
I think that's the key thing that the PRC is worried about at this point.
People's Republic of China.
Yeah, People's Republic of China is worried about, because they don't know. Well, probably U.S. also worried about it, because the President Chen has 2 months of tenure, and we don't
know. Could he create a lot of problems in those 2 months?
Yeah, that could be true. And like, for example, like yesterday, in the campaign, he just said that he won't lay the government to any person who has a possible green card. The green card is a key issue, is one of the key issues that Frank Shea campaigned about, because he attacked Mr. Ma that Mr. Ma had the permanent residency of the U.S. In maybe 30 years. So I think President Chen sent a signal. Well, maybe because of his campaign rally, but there's some kind of uncertainty about President Chen, whether or not he will hand over the government to the next president, and there will be some kind of
concern about transition too. Then.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I mean, actually, anxiety or that he will try to maintain his power or stay in power, say like Musharraf. There's concern.
Well, I don't. That. Probably not, but there are going to be some perplex. Over the next 2 months, I think so. And there's a lot of uncertainty about his presidency.
Now let's bring in our callers. And we go to you first, Wendy. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Yes, I'd like to have 3 questions. One thing is that, is it true that China has 800 missiles aimed at Taiwan if Taiwan declares independence? I believe that they passed some kind of law, like last year or a couple years ago, said that if Taiwan declares independence, that they're going to take, they're going to use force. And the second thing is that...
Well, let's take that question first. So we know that China has 800 missiles aimed at Taiwan?
Yeah. And...
That is a fact.
That's a fact. Actually, I think it's more than 1,000 now.
Yeah, I was going to say 800 sounds...
800 plus.
Yeah, more than 800 now. Yeah.
Right.
And I'm sorry, your second question, Wendy?
And the second question is, after after the Second World War, Japan declared, they lost the war. Shouldn't Taiwan declare independence because Taiwan was part of that, was the colony? And I believe that most of the colonial countries in the past, when there's war, they usually declare independence, right? Is that true?
Yes. I think there are several different arguments about it, and simply call that the Taiwan's current international status is undecided. Yeah, that's one of the arguments.
But the first question is a disturbing one, whether or not China would react to an independence move on the part of Taiwan and react violently with respect to its missiles and its missile power, especially since you've got this 2-month transition period.
Right.
I mean, there's some nervousness about that.
Yeah, and I think the Chinese government couldn't reach agreement about how to approach Taiwan's, for example, like the referendum issue. And as far as I learned, that some people argue that some Chinese government officials argue that China should take some kind of action if the referendum got passed, or to do something else to send a signal to Taiwanese. But at the current point, that I think Olympic is, of course, the first priority. And in the in the short run that to sustain China's economic development is the number one priority for China. So China's current policy toward Taiwan is try not to push Taiwan toward independence. So probably not able to get the unification on the agenda, but at least not push Taiwan getting it any further. And
keep things clean, at least until the Olympics.
Right.
We'll pass into the next administration. Presumably.
Right. So their hope is not to keep the status quo. And once the next president got elected, well, one official said that they will definitely, they're very likely to open up the door regarding the cross-strait relations, and that they welcome any kind of, they will send a goodwill to Taiwan's next new president.
Again, we're talking with Eric Chenhua Yu, who is Research Fellow and Program Manager for the Democracy in Taiwan Program at the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. And our next caller is Ravi. Morning, Ravi.
Hi. So I had a few, because I've talked to some of my friends about, you know, the Taiwan independence movement before, and I'm kind of just confused in general about, like, a few things about the idea itself, right? So, like, for one, it seems to suggest that today Taiwan is not independent, that it is an integral part of mainland China, and it needs to declare independence, right? So that's sort of very much implicit in the idea of a Taiwan independence movement. And second, like, since, you know, that idea is very unclear in of itself, how is Taiwan going to go about achieving this independence, right? Are they prepared to fight China and win, or are they just waiting for the United States to step in and help? And has Chen Shui-bian or any of the people who are pushing independence, have they considered and are they prepared to accept the consequences of losing, right? What would happen if they lost in a war to China? They would then certainly lose any sort of de facto independence they have, and they would immediately become, you know, a very unfavored colony of mainland China. They'd probably make the Tibetan situation look pretty good.
Right, Ravi, you've raised certainly a lot of questions there. You've lifted a Pandora's box. Let me get a response from Eric Yu.
Okay, first of all, about Taiwan's current status, I think some scholars make a good assessment that Taiwan currently is a nation, but probably not a state because of lack of international recognition. And about the DPP's push toward independence, first of all, let's talk about the U.S. parts. And I think based on surveys in 2006, only maybe 27 or 25% of the U.S. Americans would support U.S. defensive movement if China attacked Taiwan. So there's not. I don't think the U.S. will simply just send their military troops to defend Taiwan if Taiwan declare independence, and that's probably not gonna happen. And I think that the major purpose of the DPP's independence movement, well, probably because of the election. Once you have the election, you have to mobilize the hardcore voters, and that's one of the concerns. And the other thing is that they try to push the red line. They try to push to see how far they can push. And on the other hand, in the strategic viewpoint, once you push a little bit further, you have more chips on hand to negotiate with mainland China in the future. So that's kind of the strategy. But the problem is that how far you can push and how far the Chinese government will allow you to push.
Is there any sense in Taiwan that you get that maybe some sort of compromise, well, if you call it a compromise, the sort of thing that happened with Hong Kong, that there's integration on that level.
Right, right.
Because Hong Kong has retained a lot of its autonomy, excuse me. not sovereignty, but autonomy. You know, there's a big difference between the two, obviously.
And I think even Mr. Ma wants to propose economic integration, but he said it clear that he won't seek reunification or independence and, well,
during... Status quo.
Yeah, status quo during his tenure. So, but he proposed that once the Chinese government is willing to remove all the missiles targeting Taiwan, he probably will think about, consider having the peace accord with mainland China. And, for example, like the 50 years peace accord, that we maintain the status quo over the next 50 years, and then we will see what will happen.
But isn't it, as far as economic integration, I want to read an email here on that subject, but there isn't it now pretty much the case that you've got about 40% as a ceiling in terms of integration between the mainland and Taiwan, and Mr. Ma would move that forward to such an extent that it would make an extraordinary difference.
Yeah, and there are not only 40% as a hurdle, but there are several different hurdles that on Taiwan's investment in China. And so Taiwanese business people simply use the third party, for example, like Hong Kong or Cayman Island, to invest China via these third parties. And
makes it kind of a joke almost, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and that's interesting. But even with these a lot of hurdles, the Taiwanese investment in China is about 45 to 180 billion dollars in China. So there's still a lot of money.
And how much in the Cayman Islands and places like that? Here's a listener named Carol who just gets your response to her thoughts. She says, the enormous economic and social ties between Taiwan and the mainland are the greatest force for peace across the straits. Countless factories in China are Taiwanese-owned, and Taiwanese are sending their children to China for college. The integration is massive. Our own military-industrial complex is one of the greatest forces for strife. It wants conflict so it can sell arms to the U.S. for Taiwan. As I have heard experts say, if our nation would simply stay out of the way, Taiwan and the mainland would be able to work things out.
Yeah, and the thing is that that's probably not the ideal situation to U.S. Well, some U.S., especially some people worried about China threat, wants to have Taiwan as a kind of solid base to...
But is the U.S. a big arms seller,
yes.
as she's saying? So
yes.
There is a benefit there, and of course...
Yeah.
Mainland China is selling arms to.
So I think the U.S.
All over the
well,
world.
U.S. always argued.
You
always try to have a status quo.
Let me get some more callers on here. Frank, good morning.
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
I'm a Chinese American who come from mainland.
Yes.
I have a general comment about Taiwan, the democracy in Taiwan. I think Chinese people love to see the democracy in Taiwan, which has give some examples to the Chinese in general. But I think recently, I think they're serving a bad example because we see so many internal fights between the two parties, so which makes the Taiwan economy basically stop. And besides that, I have a general comment regarding the Tibet and the Taiwan is that the country integrity is more important than the democracy. So I think this applies to both Taiwan and Tibet.
Let me get a comment from Eric Yu on your comments, and thank you for that call.
Yeah, and I do have some Chinese friends have the same sentiment that, they kind of admire Taiwan's democracy, but over the past 8 years, Taiwan's development is kind of stagnant, and because of the politics, because of the two-part because of the partisan politics.
And corruption as well.
Yeah, and corruption. Yeah. But on the other hand, you got to say that Taiwan has enjoyed the freedom of speech and freedom of express. And although we've seen a lot of negative campaigns during in this presidential election, but somehow you got to appreciate that that's part of the freedom of speech. And I think that's the key elements probably different from, key elements if you want to consider the different system between Taiwan and China.
Let me thank Frank for his call. Let's fit Doug in here from Berkeley. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Question I've always kind of wondered about, it's one always hears this sort of framed as like there's unification under communist rule and then there's independence, which presumably is motivated by preserving Taiwan's democracy. And I was just sort of wondering whether in Taiwan there's any mooting of the idea that's like, say, yeah, we're fully in favor of unification as soon as the communists are willing to have a democratized mainland and stand in free and fair elections in China, And, you know, when give us a year to set up our political organization throughout the mainland, and the Taiwanese parties can run an election, maybe end up being the president of a unified China. And until then, say, you know, we need our own separate kind of institutions and statehood, you know, representation of the UN, until such time as China is willing to be unified as a democratic country. And I'm just wondering, it seems like that would be a third option. I'm just wondering, is that just a political non-starter in Taiwan, or, yeah.
That is the big carrot for China. We're going to reunify. All we need is a democracy.
Yeah, I think Doug's comments is right, that we do have the surveys about it. And, currently, if you ask, just simply ask Taiwanese about the unification and independence, maybe, and status quo, well, more than 50% choose status quo. But if you ask the people that once China got democratized, and do you want to unify with mainland China, and over 60% say yes. So you can see that the democracy or democratic system is a key issue between Taiwan and China, and it's a key element that you can separate the two political entities. So yes, you are right.
But you're suddenly going to get mainland China to say we're going to be democratic. I mean, this is a pipe dream, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a pipe dream.
Well, I want to thank you, Eric. Eric Chen Wai-Yu, again, is research fellow and program manager for the Democracy in Taiwan program at the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. Appreciate very much your being with us.
Thank you.
We are coming up on another hour of Forum and are decidedly going to shift gears in the hour ahead. We're going to hear about a composer that you probably have never heard about, but certainly are hearing a lot about now, because a lot is doing here in San Francisco to, well, bring her back. Not only a composer, but a performer, a mezzo-soprano, and performer and pianist. We'll find out all about Pauline Viardot in the hour ahead. And then in the second part of that hour, believe it or not, we're going to talk about women surfers, also something you don't actually hear much about. But they're growing in number, and they're making their mark. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, producer, Kevin Guillory, as well as our production assistants, Tina Larberg, Angus Strobsdorf, Polly Stryker, and Nick Vidinsky. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.